We're going over to the UK now to speak to Catherine Mannix, who spent her medical career working with people who have incurable advanced illnesses. Her first book, With the End in Mind, was a Sunday Times bestseller. Her latest book is Listen, How to Find the Words for Tender Conversations, which will help you to say the right things in the face of change and challenge. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks very much for joining us. First of all, I must applaud you on doing what must be a very difficult job.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege. I worked in palliative care for 30 years and I stepped sideways and took early retirement a few years ago to start to try and address the problem of people really not understanding what happens ordinarily when we're dying and being so afraid of it that they can't even talk about it. So the first book, which has been translated into multiple languages now, was about how people live while they're dying and what happens when we're dying. But the correspondence from that was, okay, you've convinced us we probably do need to talk about this kind of stuff. How do we do that then? And that's how this book came to be born.
I mean, doing what you do, you must be in some very sad situations and around people who are obviously very sad, watching their loved ones die. How are you able to distance yourself? I mean, most people were probably aware of when you're watching actors on television dying in films and TV shows that it can affect you and make you cry. But when you're actually in there in person and these are real people, how do you not get really upset?
I think that's a great question. And you'd think by now, after all these years, I'd have a great answer for you, wouldn't you? But the truth is that actually you do get upset, and that being upset is okay because it's part of being compassionate. I mean, clearly, if you lose control and you're weeping and your poor patient is having to give you the tissues and calm you down, that's not so helpful to them, right? But to not feel that this is really important and tender and poignant for this person and for the people who they love around them would be far worse, I think, than being able to be indifferent. Mm-hmm. So I think those of us who work alongside people who are living the last part of their lives, you know, visiting them at home or, you know, when they can fit us in because they've got better things to do than talk to us a lot of the time. The thing that we're aware of is the balance in their lives, that they may be having small periods of time when they're talking very intensively about their wishes for end-of-life care, their wishes for the future happiness of the people they're having to say goodbye to, where they want to be looked after, those sorts of things. But that's only a tiny part of what's going on for them. An awful lot of the time what's going on for them is realizing how precious every moment is and relishing it and living the best way they can, which is why, of course, good symptom management, which is the other aspect of palliative care, is so important. And we see those sad moments, but we also see the triumphs and the wonderful things that people are able to achieve. And that helps us to keep balance.
I saw a meme recently, which really made me smile and think. I can't remember exactly the words that was said, but it was to do with the fact that so often in life, you know, we can be worried about the material things and, you know, how much money we've got, the size of our house or all that kind of stuff. And then in those last final moments, none of those things are remotely important at all. And it's all to do with family or friends or people. That's what's important. And it's just a kind of gentle reminder throughout our lives to maybe prioritize family more.
They're absolutely right. And at the very end of people's lives, they've really worked out what's important. And it's not stuff. No. It's all about relationships. It's all about love. It's all about putting things right. And we hear these same messages over and over again. People want to be able to have these conversations that their families feel a little bit awkward about having because they involve saying things like, thank you, and I'm really grateful to you, I really appreciate who you've been in my life. Well, we feel a little bit awkward about being thanked and praised, don't we? So families try and shut that down. Or people want to say, I'm sorry, I was really mean to you that time. Or, you know, I let our relationship drift for all those years and I want to put that right. And now we feel really awkward because we're being apologized to. And people want to say, I love you. And that's the message we hear over and over again at the end of people's lives. So I've written Listen, really to be a kind of guidebook for how do we step into conversations that we know are going to feel emotional. We might feel a little bit awkward, but what's going to be in this conversation is really, really important. And they're not just deathbed conversations. You know, there's conversations between teens who are working out who they are and the adults who want to advise them, but the teens don't want their advice, those kind of questions. The sort of questions when people have a backstory that they need to know more information about as they get older. And it's sad to, for example, tell children who come from a different biological family about sometimes the difficult family beginnings that they had. We don't want those children to have that sadness, but it's their right to know their whole backstory. So Listen is talking about not what to say, because there can't be a script, but how to get ourselves alongside somebody else in a way that is tender and receptive, and that will allow the conversation then to proceed.
And also whether it's about saying the right things or asking the right questions, or whether the most important thing is to listen.
Oh, that's absolutely the thing. We really think when there's a big issue to get down and talk about, that what we think we need to do is talk. And when you look at social media, what we do on social media is we declare things, we state our positions, we kind of shout, this is what I think. And these conversations are almost completely the opposite of that. That first of all, the timing of it has to suit both people. So I might really want to talk to my friend about this difficult thing, but today might not be the right day for my friend. So instead of demanding the conversation, we've got to invite, to say, I would really like to talk about this sometime, because I want to hear your wisdom on it. I want to hear your perspective about it. I want to understand better what happened to you when this thing happened to both of us. So starting by inviting gives them some of the power, and it's all about power sharing. So we're not doing the conversation to somebody, we're sharing a conversation with somebody. And the thing that you will really know as a radio person is that the quality of listening is so important, that if we listen to somebody and all we're doing is letting them speak while we just wait to say the next thing we want to say anyway, we're not really listening. We're just taking turns. But what you're doing with your guests is listening to each thing they're saying, and the next question that you're going to ask is leading on from what they said. So in these conversations, in our families and friendship groups, you can't know what you're going to say next until the other person's finished speaking. And that might mean there's a moment of silence, which we feel very anxious about. And silence is the most important component of these conversations. It's where we think, it's where we make our minds up, it's where we change our minds. So we shouldn't be rushing these conversations and speak, speak, speak. But as you say, questions, asking, and then really, really listening to the answers.
I wish other people who I spoke to understood the concept of an interview as well as you do. Because the amount of times people say, can you provide me with a list of questions, please? And I'm like, no, because I don't prepare a list of questions. This is a conversation, exactly how you've just described it. And depending what you say, I'm listening to what you're going to say, and then it's going to make me think of something else to say or to ask you. That's how a conversation works. And that's how I want the interviews to come across, and preparing questions just wouldn't work.
No, and so preparing a script to talk to your family about something that's difficult to talk about isn't going to work in the same way. Perhaps you could have a little script, like you have a script at the beginning, that says, you know, mum, dad, sister, brother, husband, child, partner, friend I fell out with. I'd really like to talk about something. This is the thing I'd like to talk about. And now I'm in your hands. It's up to you whether you agree even to talk to me about it, and you choose the time and the place, and I'll be ready when you are. Because if it's that important to me, I'm prepared to step up to the way you want to have the conversation. But it can only ever be an invitation, can't it? And we get caught up with, I don't even know how to raise it. And we're so worried about raising it that we don't start. So maybe the idea of an invitation where all you're going to do is raise it. You're not going to raise it and then gallop into the conversation. You're just going to say, I've got something really important to tell you, Mum and Dad. And that might be that you've lost your job, that you decided to move overseas, that you've got the most fabulous job in the world, but it's 2 plane rides away. You might be saying your marriage is over. You might be saying you're pregnant. You might be saying you're coming out. It could be anything. You don't have to start that conversation. You simply need to say, I've got something that's really important to me that I'd really like to discuss with you. And when could we do that? And now you've taken the step you were terrified of taking, the whole thing will open up.
It's interesting what you said earlier about the timing needs to be right. I think too often people use the phrase, I'm always there for you, day or night, whenever you need me, I'm always there for you, which of course sounds lovely and is a lovely thing to say to someone. But in reality, that's simply not true. Most people have a job or have children to look after, have housework to do, have a social life even, you know, have things to do that they can't necessarily drop to be there for someone all the time. So I think it can be dangerous to kind of offer yourself to be there for someone whenever they need you, when in reality, that's not possible.
I think you're right. And there's a danger also of setting ourselves up then to let somebody down.
Yeah.
And also to be a bit heroic, you know, don't call anybody else. I'm all you need. Whereas actually what could be really helpful when a friend is going through a difficult time or a family member is to say, why don't we set up a support group for you? Because between us, there's bound to be one of us who's available in the next hour or so if you need help, rather than I'll do it day or night. And then some people then try to live up to that and absolutely exhaust themselves and make themselves sick. I think another thing that's worth thinking about is somebody suddenly decides that they are going to take you up on that offer of that conversation that you wanted. And you know that you haven't got the time now. So just as you were offering the power before, you know, this is a partnership of equals in this conversation. I'm inviting you, but you decide when. This is still a partnership of equals. You've got to be able to say, do you know what? I'm so glad you want to talk to me about that. And right now, I've got 10 minutes before I've got to go for my bus, or I've got 25 minutes before it's the pickup from school or whatever it is. So if you think that'll be enough time, I'm yours. But to me, it sounds like that probably isn't enough time. Shall we both think now when would be a good time in the next few days for us to have this conversation? So we're not running away, but we're sidestepping so that the space that that conversation needs is going to be properly allocated and valued and protected. So we can say no, but we're saying no and yet let's do it then. We're not just saying no, and neither are we saying, oh yes, I'm going to drop everything. My children can stay by the school gate for the next hour and a half. You know, we've got to live real lives, haven't we? We've got to be honest with each other, and people really appreciate that honesty. If they know you'll say no when you need to say no, they'll be far less anxious about asking for your support, because they know that you will appropriately boundary it. When you say yes, your yes is genuine.
I can really tell that you do what you do because you have such a lovely calming voice. I feel safe in your hands, if that makes sense.
Oh, what a lovely thing to say. I think my children would really laugh about that, because they would probably say, oh, mum's doing the voice, and you know, the really, really calm voice that says, "You are just in so much trouble."
Oh, I don't feel that. Oh, it's funny, isn't it? Are you aware of the, not just of the power of voice, because you must be obviously doing what you do, but is it a conscious thing about kind of not putting on a voice, but being aware of the voice that you're using? Or does it just kind of come naturally depending on the situation that you're in?
Well, I think because I've been doing this for a long time now, I've learned about use of voice, because I can remember being anxious during conversations about telling somebody, you know, unwelcome diagnosis or news about their illness that wasn't good news, and observing that my voice was high and squeaky and that I was uncomfortable, and that that discomfort communicates itself to the whole room, and then the whole room feels uncomfortable. Mm. And when you watch a really experienced nurse or paramedic or doctor, I have to say I learned this from nurses, I think, going into a room where there's, you know, hell on the other side of the door is going on, you know, there's some kind of terrible family situation, there's difficult illness, the paramedics have come in to find out why somebody's collapsed. As they go through that door, they do this remarkable thing where they morph, and their body kind of changes shape in some way. It's less angular. All their movements are smoother and purposeful, but not rapid. And you watch them slow down the way they're speaking, and you hear their voices drop in pitch. And they say, you know, here I am, and explain to me what's going on. What do I need to know very quickly so that I can help you to deal with this? That kind of message.
Mm.
And that demeanor, that kind of bending of time where they slow themselves down and it looks as though there's more time available than there really is, His voice and body language calms everybody else in the room down, which then makes better use of the time that is available. And I suspect that as nursing students, medical students, paramedic students, whatever, we imitate the best people. And eventually all of our good habits are a mixture of the good habits that we've observed and assimilated from those fantastic practitioners. So I'm not aware that I'm doing it, except when I'm in a real panic. And when something really bad is happening, I do say to myself, okay, right now, you've got to do that slow down thing, because otherwise this is going to spin out of control for these frightened people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a real skill, isn't it? And it makes all the difference. I mean, can you imagine a paramedic coming into a tragic situation and saying, oh my goodness, so what's going on here? How long have they been like that? You know, and really, really stressed and high pitched. And immediately that would completely make the situation worse for everybody.
It would ramp the whole thing up, wouldn't it? And as you're describing it, I'm thinking, both A, that would be terrible, and B, wouldn't that make an excellent comedy sketch? Because it's kind of the exact opposite of what's supposed to happen. You know, the terrified paramedic would just be such a brilliant comedy sketch. Yes. And it's that comedy, it's that, it should definitely not look like this, I think, that tells us what it is that we do value and that we do see that's helping us and is the way to behave in those difficult situations. So if you could kind of think of what your kind of most gauche friend would do that would just wind the situation up in the wrong direction, what you're aiming for is kind of the opposite of that.
Yes, yes, brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, there's a massive amount of advice and guidance in there. It's called Listen, How to Find the Words for Tender Conversations, and it's by Catherine Mannix, who we've been chatting to. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us. It's been really lovely chatting with you.
Hannah, I loved it. Thank you so much.